Well, welcome to our seminar again. Today we'll have the pleasure of having invited Peter Pomeranchev. Let me briefly give an introduction of him. He's an expert in everything that has to do with propaganda, disinformation, manipulation, conspiracy theories, everything, all of those menaces that we know are affecting our cyberspace and have an enormous influence on our politics and in general on our communication. Well, Peter Pomeranchev is a fellow of Agora Institute and at John Hopkins University. He participates, generally we can read him in some of the best journals in the English language. Of course, it's also being translated into many other languages. We can read him in the London Review of Books, in the Financial Times, the New Yorker, the Atlantic, and journals such as, or newspapers such as those. Among his books, I could mention The Art of Propaganda, his marvelous book, Nothing is True and Everything is Possible, or more recently, Adventures in Modern Russia. It's also been translated into Spanish. I think there are at least two books already translated, and probably there's someone else and another one in the process. So thank you very much, Peter, for being here with us today. And yours is the floor.
Thank you very much. And thank you for this opportunity. Just so I know, is there translation happening? Should I go really slowly for the translator, or is translation happening? Okay. If the translator wants me to slow down at any point, just tell me. I've often been...
Will do, don't worry.
So our topic today is what people know as disinformation, but really I much prefer to think about this long crisis that we're going through as a structural disintegration of the public sphere, to misquote Habermas. What we're really dealing with now, and I live in the US, it's particularly pronounced here. I'm at the Lyndon Johnson Library right now in Texas. But there's Lyndon Johnson's right behind me. you know, it's really since 2014, I think, 15, definitely 16. You know, in America, there's been these agonies over disinformation, polarization. But really, the crisis that we're facing is much deeper. It really is about how we, or whether we can, organize a pluralistic democratic discourse, which enables democracies to function as well. As you said, I'm a member of the Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University. It's named Agora after the ancient Greek agora, the marketplace, which was also the place where Athenians would gather to debate policy and come to decisions. And that's the mission of the institute that I work in. How can we think about the public square of the future? Now, I think simply defining this problem as about disinformation really misses the point. The crisis that we face, and we're talking about the crisis and possible solutions today, really gets to the sort of the root of the way we've thought about regulating democratic discourse and how we think it is meant to result in the sort of discourse that leads to debate, trust at the same time, and also the ability to make communal decisions, hold elections, believe in the results of those elections. And I think what we see is a crisis in how we thought democratic discourse was meant to work. We had, I think, a lot of assumptions about it. So in America, especially, there was a very prevalent theory, completely untested, about the marketplace of ideas. That lots of sources would produce a lot of information, disinformation, lies, arguments, and somehow the best information would rise to the top. Based on some completely untested theory of rational choice, that people, if presented with the right information, would choose it. Maybe not immediately, but eventually. Now, everything we've been seeing the last 8 to 9 years shows what a weak idea that was. Over and over, in study after study, we see people ignoring information, even when it's good for them, as in the case of COVID. We see people hiding within what some researchers call filter bubbles or echo chambers. These are imperfect terms, but they've become popular. We see instances of confirmation bias where people choose the information that they want. That's always been there, but in a world of social media where you can select your own reality, or seem to select your own reality, you can do that even more. And since 2016, there's been a sort of a reaction to how do we deal with this. And one of the reactions has been in the regulatory space. How do we pass laws that try to counteract this? But here's where it gets very, very complicated. I'm just going to share for a moment something that most of you, I think, will know, or many of you will know, which is a quote from the Declaration of Human Rights, Article 19 of the Declaration of Human Rights, which is our kind of fundamental, sort of international law around freedom of expression. So everyone has the right to freedom of opinion expression. This right includes freedom to hold opinions without interference and to seek, receive, and impart information ideas through any media and regardless of frontiers. So there's nothing here which mentions disinformation. There's nothing here which actually says anything about truth and lies or any such qualitative distinctions. And since 2016, it's been very painful to see how different groups who all want to defend democracy have been colliding over this principle. There are many people who want to defend democracy by protecting it from lies, from manipulation, who say we need to pass laws on disinformation. We need to stop this tide of lies. And their friends, also people who want to defend democracy, but who are lawyers and human rights experts, say what you're doing is authoritarian. There is absolutely nothing in our laws on free speech that have anything to do with limiting speech. And disinformation is a part of speech. And we've been in a sort of logjam, unable to move forward. So that's been the regulatory crisis. The second crisis is around the role of media, both social media, as in like the technology of online media, and media as in journalism. And this is particularly true where I live, in America. We always had this belief that pluralism, having more media, would lead to better debates and better democracy. The more contending voices we have, the better it is. It's authoritarian societies that limit the amount of media. More was meant to equal better. But now we see the opposite happening. We see so much pluralism, so many points of view that audiences can fragment into warring online and digital media groups and no longer seem to have the ability to communicate with each other. The result is, in America, for example, the sort of almost non-stop gridlock in Congress, and now the point where one third of Americans doesn't believe that the last elections were won fairly. So these are very systemic challenges. Yeah, we used to think that more information and having regulation that encouraged more information would be better for democracy, but it's also enabled this flood of disinformation. We used to think that pluralism would automatically lead to better democracy, but we see pluralism now undermining the functioning of democracy. Now, you mentioned my first book. In my second book, I actually try to put this in context. I tell the story of my parents. They were dissidents in the Soviet Union. They were arrested by the KGB for reading the wrong books, for giving banned books to their friends, for fighting for more information. That was always the story of the interaction between democracy and information, the demand for more information, more pluralism. That's how you fought the enemies of democracy. But now we're in this new world. So what can we do? I think over the last 8 years, because this is now a long crisis, it's been lasting really since 2016, I think, is when it emerged as a clear issue. I think we've all been on a very long journey. And I think we are slowly arriving at the ideas of how you can start solving it. So let's start with the regulation piece. How can we approach the regulation of this new world without abandoning the principles of Article 19? So let's put it up again. I think you see it, yeah, when I put it up? Yeah? This boring paragraph, boring, important paragraph. Everyone has the right to freedom of opinion expression. This right includes freedom to hold opinions without interference and to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas through any media and regardless of frontiers. I think the part that's always forgotten here and that we can really make use of in the challenges that we face today is receive. Now, let me explain why this is very important and why this can be the part of Article 19 that can help bring a better public sphere without rewriting these laws. So as I mentioned, we have or seem to have more information than ever before. But we live in a paradox. On the one hand, we have more information than ever before. On the other, we have less information than ever before about how our information environment is shaped and formed. When we go online, on social media, we don't understand at the moment why a social media platform shows us one piece of content or another. Yeah. We don't understand how the algorithms order information for us. We don't understand which of our own information is being used in order to then target information at us. We don't understand if our neighbor is seeing the same content that we are seeing. So paradoxically, even though there's more information than ever before, our understanding of the information environment, how it's shaped, is much less. Previously, you would know who was the owner of a newspaper. You would understand why they might give some information, not others. You could sit back and critically analyze it. Now, when I open my Facebook page, let alone my TikTok page, I really have no understanding how information is being ordered, who is behind, or which of my own information is being used to direct information at me. I think we can see this as, in its own way, a form of censorship. As a citizen, I should have the right to understand these things. If I want to criticize and engage critically with my information environment, I need to have this transparency. It's almost as if we have to rip away the backstage of how the information environment is shaped. Maybe it needs to be like, if you want to use a metaphor, and I guess I'm hungry, it's lunchtime here. We need to open up, like in a contemporary restaurant, open up the kitchen of how in the information environment is shaped so we can see into it and understand how information is prepared for us. That, I think, can be the essence of the regulatory approach. That is completely in keeping with the spirit and the letter of our ideas about freedom of information. We're not calling to ban something. We're not calling to stop something called disinformation, which we really can't define very well. We're asking for more information in order to understand how we see what we see and how we're influenced by what we see. Now, what would be the consequence of that? I'll give you one consequence. In Britain, during the Brexit referendum, all sides, but particularly the side that campaigned for the Brexit referendum, were sending different ads to different people in order to get them to vote for Brexit. I interviewed the head of the digital campaign for Brexit in my last book, which I think is available in Spanish. And he told me, and you need to check my book to see the exact number, that you need around 40 different narratives that you give different parts of society to sell what you want them to vote for. So he was telling one group of society, vote for Brexit to stop immigration. He was selling another bit of society, vote for Brexit because it's good for animal rights, because the EU sponsors farms, this was his argument, that support bullfighters and bullfighting, And that's bad for animal rights. So if you're English and you want to stop abuses of animal rights, vote for Brexit. Now, each one of those bits of society has no idea that the other one is being told that. Yeah? The people who are being targeted with these ads have no idea they're being targeted by them because the propagandist knows these things about them from their Facebook profiles. And the result is when we've voted for Brexit, as a society, we couldn't understand why we'd voted for it. Some people were saying, we voted for sovereignty. Others, we voted against immigration. A third were saying, hold on, we voted for animal rights. There'd been no moment of common debate. When you have posters on the street or adverts on TV, we can all see the ads and we can all debate it and dispute it. And the other side can counter it. But when you have, as we currently still do, this information architecture where one group of people see one thing, another, and we have no common space to debate it, then we can't come to these difficult communal decisions together. And that's what regulation can change. Regulation can make sure that everybody has the right to know what their neighbors saw. That what I will understand if I'm being targeted with an ad is the propagandist sending a different ad to somebody else. I should have the right to understand that. So that is the very limited role of regulation. Not to stop disinformation, which is something that you'll lose at the European Court of Human Rights if you ever try to pass a law like that, but to create a more open space. So that's the first step that we need to take. And I see some progress in the Digital Service Act, the EU Digital Service Act, which is moving towards a concept not a million miles away from this. Sadly, in America, we see the opposite happening. Because the debate around propaganda, disinformation, has itself become so polarized. In the attempt to solve polarization, the debate has become polarized, where each side accuses the other one of wanting to regulate it for their own reasons. There's no progress with regulation at all. And quite the opposite, things are getting worse in many ways. We have even less right to understand what is going on the platforms. But regulation can only do so much. We cannot regulate our way out of problems to do with information. It would be very, very bad, I think, for the nature of democracies if they would start to use laws to solve all these problems. At the end of the day, we need to be able to create media and other communications tools which can compete with the people who produce lies and hatred. Now, how can we do that? I see two types of intervention which are already being experimented with but need to be grown. But first, it's worth understanding the scale of the challenge that we faced. And sometimes it's worth putting it in historical perspective. What we're talking about is really quite ambitious. What we'll be talking about is the need to create a media based on completely different principles to what we have right now. But we have faced this challenge before. In the 1920s, radio emerges, much like the internet has emerged more recently. And as radio emerges, it is first romanticized. Poets and philosophers celebrate radio as this beautiful technology that will end all wars, that will bring people together, because people will be able to hear each other in different countries and there will be no more wars. Radio will bring peace on earth. A little bit like when social media first appears, well over a decade ago now. There is first this dream that social media will bring down dictators, connect people across divides. A huge romanticization. Now with radio, after this first romantic period, there's then a period of horror as the forces that learn to use radio most effectively are Hitler, Goebbels, Stalin, Father Coughlin, who was the first great radio talk show host in America. He was pro-Hitler and anti-Semitic. So it's the forces of evil who work out that you can use this new medium to release forms of anger and hatred that had been taboo. The appearance of a new media opens up the norms. And that seems to always have a negative side effect of empowering the worst in humanity. And same with social media. After a first romantic phase, everything seems to change. And the powers that use social media best are dictators like Putin, authoritarian populists, conspiracy theorists, anti-Semites, far-right extremists. Now, in the 1920s, in Britain, the reaction to this moment, to the way radio had been hijacked by dictators, was the BBC. The BBC emerged as a reaction to the polarization of the tabloid newspapers and the exploitation of radio by dictators. And the founder of the BBC, John Reith, spoke about it not just as a media, but as a public sphere. He actually invoked the idea of an agora, that the radio would be like the marketplace of antiquity. It would be the place where society would come together, where different parts of society would be represented in order to have a democratic debate. So that is, you know, if you think about how the BBC grew into the world's largest media organization, that is the size and the scope and the ambition that we need today. Now, it won't take the form that it did in the 1920s and 30s and 50s. In order to think of creating a media that creates a public sphere, that creates the new agora today, it would have to have, and I'd love to hear your thoughts as well, several key components. The first one is less to do with content and more to do with design. It would have to be not necessarily a broadcast media, but a digital and what we think of now as a social media. Now, the old broadcast model of public media was that you bring representatives of society onto radio, onto television, and thus create a metaphor of society inside the media, and that reflects back to society. Yeah. Public service media like the BBC were meant to be a microcosm of the whole of society. You watched it, you saw yourself, and were reflected back. In the age of social media, that doesn't work anymore. What you have to do is create technological platforms which are designed in a way to engage different parts of society together. That is not how they're designed today. The way a Facebook, a Twitter, an Instagram, or a TikTok are designed, it is to feed different people different things, to give you what you want and push you ever further into a distant place where the content you receive constantly reinforces what you watched already, thus separating you from other bits of society. So it's based on fragmentation. And secondly, it's based on feeding the content that usually, not always, but usually feeds the most extreme emotions and behaviors. And the reason for this is economic. It's got very much to do with group dynamics. In order to engage, to share media, and to become popular in a social media community, the quickest way to do that is to take the most extreme position. Yeah, so if it's a group of moderate Republicans, the way you become popular is to be the most extreme one. And the content that you will be fed and the content that becomes popular is then the most extreme one. And the aim of going online is to get likes, retweets, shares. That's the logic. And you get more by doing content which is more extreme, so the algorithm feeds you more extreme content. Now, we can design things completely differently. This is a design choice that has a huge social effect. And there are examples of this. There's a great project in Taiwan, WeTaiwan, which is an algorithm that is designed in such a way that it brings people's statements on a topic closer to each other. When people post on a subject that can be quite difficult, a new tax or something, the algorithm will find the statements that bring people on different sides together and highlight those statements. So people from different sides start to move towards one another. So the essence of the algorithm, the way it is designed, is improving democratic discourse. Now, what do we mean by democratic discourse? I've used the word continuously. And in COVID, myself and a few other colleagues, we organized a whole series of workshops where we try to just understand from people, what do we mean by democratic discourse? We know when we don't have it. We can see when things are going wrong. We can see when society is incapable of having a debate that leads to any kind of productive output. But what do we mean by a positive debate, a democratic debate? And after many, many workshops, I think we landed on two or three very simple axioms. And I'm very thankful to Deb Roy from the Massachusetts Institute for Technology, who really helped clarify this. And they're really very, very simple. Number one, and this is the baseline, you need to have an environment where people are able to talk to each other with respect to each other's humanity. So not to demonize each other, to be even able to have that initial discourse where they can listen to the other. Sounds simple, but incredibly difficult. Where I live in America, there are whole parts of society that simply do not want to hear the other part. That's number one. Number two, it's an environment where people can agree on what evidence is. It's not everybody has to agree on the same facts, but they have to be able to decide together what is a fact. And number three is that the debate leads to political decisions. So it's not just what the Germans call Quatsch. It's not just chatter. These are actually constructive conversations that lead to communal decisions being taken. So we need to think of a media environment and a social media design that enables all three of those things. Being able to see the humanity of others, being able to agree on what evidence is, and number three, a debate that leads to a political outcome. Now let's try to break each one of those stages down. And we can start to, I think, imagine the sort of interventions that we so badly need. The first one, in terms of seeing the humanity of others. Again, this sounds so vague, it sounds so romantic, but really it's the sort of effect which I think can only be achieved through the creative arts, through movies, through TV shows. When I traveled around the parts of Britain after 2016, after Brexit, that had voted for Brexit, I kept on asking them, you know, why did you do this? What were your motivations? And one thing they kept on coming back to is that nobody tells stories about us. We don't feel that we have any worth in society. These weren't always parts of Britain that were poor, frankly. This wasn't just about economic hardship. Actually, most of the places were very, very wealthy by any type of global standard. But they felt that they had been forgotten. There were no more movies made about them. There was no prestige in being from these parts of the country. There was no heroism to it. If you're a guy, you couldn't get a girl if you were from this part of the country. And I think the only way to respond to that, because this really is a gap in perception, not an economic want, is to make sure that all parts of your society feel listened to. And there's many ways of doing that, but I think one of the most important is storytelling. And again, it sounds easy, but it's something that isn't happening. I mean, in America, there aren't humane films and stories and shows being made across the partisan divide. That means investing in this. That means a film and TV industry who sets it as its mission. In a very simple way, even without getting into the creative arts, it would mean in America, a CNN or an MSNBC, one of the liberal media, to open up many, many offices in the center of America where they would start to cover the lives of people there, which they haven't done. Quite the opposite. Their economic incentive is to increase polarization, which is why America is in such a dangerous place. That's number one. Number two is how do we create an environment where evidence and facts can matter. And this is a very challenging question. But it means designing conversations where facts become important again. How do we stimulate conversations where evidence plays a role, where people are motivated to even want facts in the first place? Now, in political discourse, I think facts are very, very tied to an idea of the future. Yeah? It is not a coincidence that so many of the so-called authoritarian populists, whether it's a Putin, a Bolsonaro, an Orban, a Trump, these politicians who are associated with enjoying lying, with throwing off factual language. They're also nostalgists. That's actually the one thing they have in common. Because when you're dealing with nostalgia, you really don't need the facts at all. Facts appear, or the need for facts appears in political conversations when you're having a conversation about the future, a future that you're trying to achieve and that you need evidence to show that you are achieving, that you want to do this for your village or town, build this road, this is how you're going to raise the money, this is how you're going to do it. That's a very sort of basic example. But more broadly, the moment you get into a conversation about a rational future, you start to get the need for evidence and facts. You have to prove how you'll achieve it. Now, in America right now, we've been having presidential debates during the primaries. And it was very striking how the primary debates on television were designed in a way that you don't need facts. I don't know if you've ever seen them, but you have 10, 12 candidates, each of who wants to be president. And they have a few minutes to say what they want to say. And the only way for that to, for them to get more time is to attack the other people in the debate. Because then the other person will reply to them and they will have more time. So the whole thing is designed on purpose, much like a reality TV show. If you want to get attention, you attack the other person personally, viciously, insultingly, and hope that they react to you so you can attack again. This is a performance game. It can be very funny. But obviously, facts of the future don't come into any of this conversation. You could build a debating show very differently. You could give the candidates a policy problem to solve, ask them how they would solve it, how they would work with each other to solve it, and how they would vote with the other side to solve it. Immediately, they'd be in a conversation where they have to prove and show what they're trying to achieve. So just immediately a little tweak that takes the conversation towards a goal, towards a solution, towards a future. Immediately, you can have a conversation where facts matter. And thirdly, if we're talking about how do these conversations then translate into policy, there are many examples, but perhaps one of the most clearest ones and evidence-based ones in terms of knowing that it's successful is issues like municipal, communal municipal budget making, which has been pioneered in Brazil and many other places, where the whole town has the right through digital technologies to play a role in deciding the local budget. It doesn't sound very exciting, but actually it's incredibly meaningful. Every town that it's been tried in across the global south and Europe, it's very, very successful. Funnily, the mayors who let this happen tend to be voted back in because people enjoy so much being part of the political process, and digital technologies makes it very possible. However, it's not done to a huge extent because it means a small relinquishing of power by those in charge, and they tend to be very worried about it. So just to recap, because I'm already 46 minutes in and we want to chat a little bit. This is not a problem of, what we're facing is not just a problem of disinformation. And that's a symptom as much as a cause. What we're facing is a structural disintegration of the public sphere. And the solutions that we need will be partly in the regulatory space, to completely change the transparency of the information environment so we can actually engage with it in a critical way, which we can't at the moment. And then an intervention in how media is designed, practiced, and engaged with by people that is suitable to the digital age, but really in its ambition and scope is as big as the creation of public broadcasters like the BBC. That is the scale that we need. But that is also the scale of the challenge. You know, this is not a problem that will go away with a couple of fixes to the ownership of Twitter. We organize our lives around media. We conceive ourselves as groups, as nations, through media. And when the old model of media breaks down, it means building something very big from start. That was it.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much, Peter. So let's see if we have some questions here or on online. Yeah.
Hello.
Yeah.
Hi.
So you mentioned that there are several strategies to fight the low quality of our democratic discourse, and one of them was the creation of public media, which in the present means the creation of public social media. In order to do that, you mentioned that one of the things that is necessary is to change the type of algorithms that are used in this new public social media. The problem that I see is that the algorithms that are used by mainstream social media are responsible for getting the attention of the public. So if we change that and we create new algorithms that generate less provocative content and algorithms that don't segment communication, we run the risk of losing the attention of the public. So how do you see that? Do you see that as a problem, or how would you solve that?
It's a really, really, really good question. It's the old, you know, tension between tabloids, you know, tabloid newspapers, which is super popular, and public media. So in a way, this is an old question. You know, we've always had this tension between a slightly slower and more worthy public media and crazy tabloids. And look, if we have both, that's fine. You know, at the moment, we just don't have, we only have the tabloids. We don't have anything to balance it. But listen, the social media platforms need profits very, 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 very quickly. So like tabloids, they go for the simplest thing, hate, fear, tribalism. You know, that's the quickest hit. But people want to be, people have other needs. People do like being part of collaborative processes. People would, you know, I think the secret that, you know, public service media always had, and we'd have to think about how that would work today, was that it sort of became the place where we have a lot of our political debates, where groups that had been underserved would be served. So there's lots and lots of things that tabloids or, you know, tabloid-like social media are not very good at, and that people have needs of, you know. There is actually a huge joy in collaboration. It's just a slower joy and a slower pleasure. But also it's about usefulness as well. You know, if these are the places where we have our important political conversations and political debates, and that they provide a path to political change, then it also becomes sort of worth your while as well to be part of that conversation. But you're right, these public social media would have to, they might have a commercial model, but they shouldn't have a profit model that profits from sucking people's data and selling it to advertisers and so on and political parties. So yes, you're quite right. They'd have to be based on different things. And they would be there as a balance. And we'd have a mix, you know. I think of it like a city. You know, you have your fast food joints where people, you know, go and eat burgers. And they taste great, but they're not very good for you. And then they have their sort of, you know, markets which might, with much better food. They have public libraries where people come and do research. So, you know, a city should have all sorts of different types of institutions, and so should our cyber city. That too should have very different types of institutions doing different things. At the moment, everything is captured by two or three companies who are doing everything. They're doing our political debate and our sexual debate and our family communications. It's weird. I mean, the cyber city at the moment looks like Blade Runner, with like two or three huge companies dominating everything, and then this sort of, and when you can't tell the difference between who's real and who's not, and then down in the depths you have the kind of the sort of underworld and the dark net. I mean, that's not a healthy city.
Emas Porei.
Any questions from the floor?
We wait. You haven't mentioned, because you do mention it in at least in one of your books, you know, the effect of external interventions in a public sphere on part of Russia, for instance, right? So this is called this hybrid warfare, right? So and you you say something like, well, I think we're at war. I mean, it's in a way it's a non-declared war that is already existing in a cyberspace. And so when, now that we're facing, well, half of the population of the world is going to have elections this year. And particularly the most important ones are, of course, in the United States, the presidential elections, and in the European Union, European Parliament, right? In both cases, there's the threat of, you know, that the extreme right, the populist right, might be, if not winning in the European case, at least enlarging a lot its base, right? And of course, the danger of Trump. And how far do you think Russian influence might try to be active, you know, during this period? I know this shifts us a bit from your discourse,
I think it's
interesting.
It's something that we could add to the third part of this, which is the foreign policy part. But so I think what's interesting is to see what's changing. So of course they're going to use it. We know from 2016 onwards that they will use information operations to help bring their friends into power. It'll probably largely be about things like immigration, so boosting fears of immigration even further. There might be smear campaigns against politicians they don't like. There might be hacks of materials that just try to, you know, attack the politicians they don't like. We know all that. And again, some of the things I talked about, like greater transparency and a more robust media, are ways to try to counteract that. But what's happening at the moment, the next generation of this, is I think, very, very important to understand. So we see across the world, Russia, China, and Iran starting to combine their hybrid operations. And it's worth understanding, they don't think of the information space as purely the information space. So in Africa, there is a great game going on, really, where the Russians and the Chinese want to push France, obviously, very effectively. And yesterday, they pushed America out of Niger. Huge, huge story. And we've got to understand, this isn't just about elections. This is about resources. They want to control the countries which have the resources that make the technology on which we all depend. And they will use a mixture of influence operations, mercenaries, and corruption together to do that. It's what used to be known as political warfare. And yes, part of the response in the information space, but not only. So I think we're going to see more and more of that. It's not a top-down dirigiste approach, by the way. I think it's often happening on the ground. Sort of the Chinese and the Russians see opportunities. They have some common interests. They will work together. Probably the same in Europe. You know, Russia and various corrupt actors in Europe see advantages in working together and come together in these networks. But it's always a combination. There's the information operation. There's the corruption. There might be some sanctions busting. There might be a cyber operation. And so far, the West has not caught up. I think we were very arrogant. I mean, in America, certainly, my sense was that for many years, the attitude was that, yes, the Russians, maybe the Chinese do this because they're weak. We don't need to do this because we have real economic and military might. This is for the little people. Let them do their cyber and info ops. I think increasingly we're understanding that actually this is a tool of statecraft in the 21st century. And yes, you can do things to mitigate it. You can break down their networks. You can arrest the people who are the corrupt partners in these networks, break down their chain. But you also have to compete. And that means developing our own capabilities. But that just means relearning the art of political warfare, which we knew in the Second World War. I have a new book coming out about just about that. And we knew in the Cold War. But we've kind of abandoned because we thought, you know, the world had changed. We don't really have the institutions to deal with this. So I think that's changing. I think the British have certainly, they've created a secretariat for information security, which is essentially a political warfare. Well, they would deny it, but sounds a lot like what used to be known as political warfare, or at least understanding it. There's now these sort of centers for hybrid threats. So slowly, I think there's an understanding that this is actually an important dimension. But yes, I would add, you know, if we're doing a fuller map of how we need to change things for the new age, updating our defensive and also offensive poses in political warfare is going to be very, very important.
Okay, thank you. I think we have still time for a couple of questions. Javier? Yeah.
We have a question from We have a question from someone from the digital audience who would like to know what are your thoughts on the role of public and universal education in the formation of democratic citizenship. And I also have another question related to the last one, which is that recently the United States has created an organism called Foreign Malign Influence Center, which is devoted to fight propaganda and disinformation coming from foreign powers. And I would like to know, how do you evaluate this initiative? If you think that it is possible that this type of organisms end up producing some forms of censorship in the name of national interest?
So, as you'd have to enlighten me, but as far as I know, sort of all the FIMI stuff is about exposing Russian operations. I think they've exposed a couple of Russian operations in Latin America. So that's giving more information. That's not censorship, quite the opposite. It's nothing's being censored. It's just being, it's your people, you know, you're getting more information about what's going on. So I don't see any particular risk from what I know, unless there's something I'm missing. But education is key. And again, you're quite right. If we were to continue my talk today, we'd get into education as well. My worry about education is that it can also become a way of sort of blaming the victim. You know, it's your fault for not being educated enough, you know, when it's not always. It doesn't matter how educated you are about what goes on online. If we don't have an understanding of the type I talked about why algorithms prioritize one thing, not another, if the internet remains this completely sort of black box, then what are you going to be educated about? You know, in order to think critically, you need to have an object to criticize. And I don't want to romanticize the old media model at all, but you knew the media owners. I mean, you knew Rupert Murdoch owns this. I don't know, these guys own this. So you could think critically about what was going on. Here you just don't understand. So you can only think critically about things that you can see. And as long as they're in the black box, it's very, very hard. And in America, the speculation because of this is so unhealthy. You have one side going, oh, Google is actually controlled by liberals who are censoring conservative news and boosting liberal news. And you have other people saying, oh, Twitter is Elon Musk's plane thing and he's promoting, you know, extremist content and downplaying democratic content. And the thing is, we don't know. We have no idea. We can guess, we can try to do kind of research, which sort of like, you know, tries to feel our way through, but we should just have the right to know. So I don't think you can be educated about something which is a black box. You need to have something to be able to engage with. And we don't.
So there was the second question.
The second question was about this organism, but replied. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I mentioned it a bit, but yeah, from what I know, it's not about stuff in the US, it's about sort of foreign sort of operation. I think they aren't they just exposing, yeah, operations.
Yeah.
But I'm happy to learn more.
Yeah, wait a second. Let's see if we have here another question. Yeah, over there, please.
Hi, thank you for the talk. I wanted to make a question about, it's clear that changes need to be made in terms of the space in which and the ways in which we communicate on social media, for example. But I wanted to ask a question in terms of policy making and at what level these changes could be implemented. Because as you mentioned, there is a paradox in terms of democracies and freedom of speech, in which we have so much information, but that's creating many issues such as propaganda and disinformation. And I think we're inclined to believe that democracies could deliver these changes, But if by regulating social media and freedom of speech, we would violate the principles of democracy, then at what level could we implement these changes in terms of policy and reform of the media, like you mentioned, like the changes that really we need to implement to make this a better place and to reduce misinformation?
So I think we don't need to regulate speech. We already have speech regulation that already exists. You know, there's nothing that's changed in speech. You know, we have regulation based on the experience of World War II and, you know, ideas around sort of incitement to genocide. All that exists already. There is nothing that's changed in what people say. We don't need to regulate speech. What we need to think about is what is new, and that is how it's amplified, how it's targeted, how information is gathered. That is what's new in the internet. There's nothing new being said. So this is a complete, I think, kind of like, you know, we've sailed in the wrong direction. This is not about types of speech. We have to deal with what's new. And, you know, there's questions of who's, you know, responsible for types of behavior online. There's lots of very difficult questions. But I don't think we need to get caught in this trap that we're doing anything new in terms of speech. All the laws around speech are already there. No?
Okay. Well, I think I can put you the last question, and so we'll we'll let you rest a bit. Well, of course, it's implicit in every discussion nowadays, and I want to refer to AI, so artificial intelligence, right? And,
okay.
Well, we don't need the large answer, right? What do you think it would be the most dangerous aspect of AI being you know, implemented in the information sphere, right? So. What would you see the greatest dangers?
look, the dangers are discussed endlessly. You know, we're just in the election right now in the US. We had robocalls using Joe Biden's voice, telling people not to vote. You know, but I think there's something deeper going on, which is, you know, we always have this tension. Since Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, I suppose, or even further in The Legend of the Golem.
Frankenstein syndrome, yeah.
Well, I think even further, even you know, but definitely Frankenstein, which is, of course, being written during, you know, the era of industrialization, about what makes us human and where are machines. You know, this paranoia about machines taking us over is all about us trying to work out what is it that makes us human? What is that line? And so a lot of the, you know, it's an old fear. But I think in every sort of interaction with technology, we learn to define the freedom and learn to define the human again. And I think that's what's playing out. You know, there's an important and provocative book by Luciano Floridi, who's professor of ethics and internet at Oxford, called, I think, The Fourth Revolution or something. And he makes this huge claim, very provocative, that the emergence of data, big data, with AI as part of that, but he's just talking about big data, has changed what we have understood is the human. He compares it to the Copernican Revolution when we realized that we weren't the center of the universe. He compares it to the Freudian Revolution when we realized, allegedly, that we are not rational beings but driven by our unconscious. He's saying that now we understand we are just such things as data is made of. You know, we are just subsets of our own data. It's the data where what we thought our freedom individuality was actually is. Our data knows more about us than we do, and therefore can then replicate life through AI. You know, ChatGTP can write better novels than Hemingway. Maybe that's not that hard. But anyway, I'd like to take the opposite point of view. That technology defines where the new freedom is. The limits of freedom will be, and the limits of individuality will be, the things that ChatGPT cannot do. There are things that your big data can tell about you, but there are many things it can't. Yeah. It'll be very, very good at, I don't know, analyzing your shopping habits or something. But ultimately, it's not going to be very good at finding you the perfect romantic relationship or something. But in that journey, as we work out what can AI do and what can we do, what can big data do and where do we begin, we'll begin redefining what freedom is and what the individual is and what the human is. But that always comes with a lot of fear, because suddenly things that we thought were intrinsically human, intrinsically us, it turns out can actually be partly automated. So I think the fear is that there's a much deeper fear than, you know, beyond a sort of like a panic about, oh, how do we regulate ads in an election? There's always a development in election technologies and regulation is always behind. That's a very understandable fear. But the kind of existential unease that we're having around AI, I think goes to that. Yeah. Are we as free and as human as we think we are? But I'm an optimist that way, I think. I think we'll find, as with Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, that there's a big difference between the monster and the human. Just.
Okay, thanks a lot, Peter Pomarenchev. It's been a pleasure having you here today with us in Madrid or in the cyberspace, of course. Thank you very much.
In with LBJ. Okay, ciao. Bye-bye. Thank you very much. I hope it was useful.
Bueno, muchísimas gracias por su.
Well, thank you very much. We've had some audio problems, maybe. Nonetheless, we've sorted them out. We tried to invite Peter to Madrid, but he was just too busy. He couldn't make it. I strongly recommend his books that have been translated into Spanish. This is Propaganda. This is an excellent book. And his book about New Russia is very interesting. He's a son of Russian dissidents and exiles, so he's knowledgeable about the topic. We will hold a session on artificial intelligence. So I'll wait. I hope to see you soon during our next session with Elvira Lindo and Mario Calabresi. Thank you.